I ask to order, let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. Monday, February 6th, 2023. Present today are Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Colomb, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Thank you to our moderator, Emery Turner from the LIO, and our Finance Secretary, Bree Wiley, for being with us today. And I would like to introduce our new House Finance page, Luma Diaz. She's a new House Finance page, and she was formerly with the Senate, so as a Senate floor page. So welcome, Luma. Today we're receiving an overview from the Mental Health Trust Authority, Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and presenting today is Steve Williams, Chief Executive Officer, and Anita Halterman, the Board of Trustees. Mr. Williams, would you like to come forward and to the table, introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and if you have anyone else accompanying you today. And while we're allowing him to get settled, please think about your questions. We'll let him answer anything if you have anything before he starts his presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Williams, the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. And online today, we have our board chair, Anita Halterman. She will be walking through the first few slides of the presentation, and then I will be picking up the rest of it. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over for the first slide to our chair.
Just one sec. I'll ask the committee, is there anything before we get started that you have that you would like to ask or make note of? All right, seeing no questions, or perhaps I did, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair to all the wonderful members. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to all of our wonderful guests in the audience today. We have visitors all the way from the North Slope who are watching their government work on behalf of them in real time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Welcome. All right. Go ahead. You can go ahead and start your presentation.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, good. My name's Anita Halterman, and I am the chair of the Board of Trustees for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Steve and I appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee today. The trust has a unique place in state government. We are a funder, but we also apply our resources in a catalytic fashion to help improve Alaska's system of care. We do this by supporting partners and bringing on new lines of services, by supporting capacity building, workforce development, and capital projects, and through policy and planning activities. And as we share via the upcoming slides, we do this in a way that prudently and carefully manages trust resources. Before I dive in, I'll acknowledge that we are aware that our many best beneficiaries, our system is currently not meeting their needs. We know there are wait lists and increasing costs and other challenges, but we are proud of the work that we're engaged in with state, local, tribal, nonprofit, and provider partners to support meaningful change and robust continuums of services and supports for vulnerable Alaskans. I would like to introduce the rest of our board. They obviously are not in the room. However, Rhonda Boyles is our vice chair. Brent Fisher is our secretary. Verne Borner is our program and planning chair. John Sturgeon is our resource chair. Kevin Simon is our audit and risk chair. And Agnes Moran is the newest member of our board, our newest trustee. The Board of Trustees is an independent board, and we provide governance and fiduciary oversight and direction in achieving the mission for the trust. Trustees are appointed by the governor, and we must be confirmed by the legislature. We anticipate that the legislature will be considering appointments for two of our seven members of the trust board this year. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve Williams, our CEO.
Thank you, Chair Halterman. So on this slide, this is a description of who the beneficiaries of the trust are.
Representative Plum.
I was trying to get the chair's attention before you go back to the board or through the chair. So on the board, so those were, if I remember right, those are supposed to come from specific boards or boards like nominate those for the governor to look at. Do you know, or can you give me the information where these nominations come from? And why I'm asking is mainly like trying to figure out the backgrounds of each board member. Is it more a fiscal background or, you know, mental illness capacity, or what the experience is of each one?
Through the chair to Representative Colom. The nomination process for trustees is outlined in trust statute. And that involves a six-member panel that includes a representative from the trust, a representative from the Alaska Native Health Board, a representative from the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, a member from the Alaska Commission on Aging, and then a member from the Governor's Council on Special Education and Disabilities.
Okay.
And that panel, we advertise for open seats, trustee seats. Okay. They receive the applications from boards and commissions. They review those. They go through the applications as a panel. They identify who it is that they would like to interview. They conduct interviews, and then from their interviews, they send to the governor a list of recommendations for consideration for his appointment. If you would like, I can kind of quickly go through each of these trustees to give you a little bit of their background, if that's...
Is that okay, Chair?
Certainly, yeah.
Okay. So, Ms. Halterman, who is online, maybe I'll just, if it's okay, I'll let her explain her brief background and what she brings to the trust.
Thanks, Steve. I have a background with program and planning for Medicaid for many years. I have over 25 years experience working in two state Medicaid programs, one here in Alaska for many, many years, over 20, and then working in the state of Iowa. I also have an MBA, a master's in business administration, and I've served our beneficiary population through primarily working with government programs, health and social services, and I had a brief stint working in the Department of Corrections with similar populations. I have been on the board for approximately 4 years. I've been serving as the chair since January of last year. And I am going through another confirmation upcoming, so I will be talking to you all in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Halterman. And then Rhonda Boyles is from Fairbanks. She is a businesswoman from Fairbanks. She also had a family member who experienced a condition related to Alzheimer's or to dementia. Brent Fisher is from Anchorage. He has a healthcare background and in private business. Verne Berner was formerly the CEO of the Alaska Native Health Board. She is Alaska Native from the Kotzebue region and brings to the board a wealth of knowledge in terms of the state's healthcare system, both from a tribal health perspective as well as from outside the tribal health perspective. John Sturgeon, again from Anchorage, he is our resource management chair, and he has extensive experience in the timber industry and other resource development. Kevin Feynman, Anchorage, finance background. He also lived in Nome for several years, so he brings sort of experience from our rural part of the state. And then Agnes Moran, our newest trustee, who's from Ketchikan. She is experienced. She is the executive director of WISH down in Ketchikan. She also has experience, an extensive experience in addressing issues related to homelessness, and also has a financial and business background.
Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So is this legislature, are all these members subject to confirmation in this session, or just Ms. Halterman and Ms. Moran?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the two seats that are currently open and we're waiting for the appointment that will then come to the body, the legislature, for confirmation is Chair Halterman's seat and then Chair Berner's seat. So all of the other trustees, you will not, they aren't going to go through a confirmation process.
Excuse me, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through Chair Johnson, Mr. Williams, on that same thing, just following up, because Ms. Halterman is currently on and so previously been confirmed. So what? That's kind of unique, because most of the boards, if you are reappointed to another term, it doesn't mean that you go through an additional confirmation. So is it because she's chairperson, or was there a step in between hers, or is it just unique to the mental health trust board that even additional at every reappointment of a term, there's a new confirmation hearing?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, Ms. Halterman, when she was originally appointed, was filling out a term from a previous trustee. So she has completed those years. Our trustees are appointed for five-year terms, appointed and then confirmed for five-year terms. At the end of a five-year term, if a trustee wishes to continue on for a second term, they're eligible for another 5 years. They have to go through the same application, appointment, and confirmation process. And this process is outlined in statute that was a part of the settlement of the trust, litigation settlement of the trust back in 1994.
One follow-up?
Yes, follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Through the chair. That's a little unique to you guys, and that's interesting. Five-year terms means, in theory, that no executive in one term appoints them all. So those two are the terms that are currently up for review, and then are there terms expiring next year and the year after? Are they set up to stagger so that you've got one or two trustees every year changing out, or are there, you know, three terms expiring at once?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, you're absolutely right that the intent was that you would have staggered terms that would spread over the course of several years, so that you wouldn't have a cohort, if you will, of trustees whose terms are expiring at one time and then having to go through the process. I believe next year, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I can follow up in response to the committee. I think there's one trustee that might be up for completing their first five-year term, and then if they want to continue on, they'll have to go through the process.
Thank you.
Great. So the beneficiaries of the Alaska Mental Health Trust are up on the screen. These are Alaskans who experience any of these five health conditions or a combination thereof. They include both youth, adolescents, and adults. And Representative Hannon's question about the trust is a really good one, and sort of elements of the trust and how we were established in a litigation settlement. And I thought for the committee, showing a brief video about the history of the trust so that there's a solid understanding of where we come from, because the history of the trust is pretty complex. We're unique. There's nothing like the trust anywhere else in the country. And there are other states that are envious of the fact that Alaska has a mental health trust. So this will be a short 3-minute video. It's also on our website under that you can go to if you want to view it again or share it with others.
This is a story about something called the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the trust for short. It's pretty complex, but for many Alaskans who need help dealing with mental health issues, the trust often means the difference between a healthy, productive life much different than that. The trust was created in 1994 after a beneficiary group sued the state of Alaska for not living up to its obligation to care for people who were mentally ill or had developmental disabilities. The two sides reached a settlement that the state granted the trust 1 million acres of land and $200 million in cash. The trust is the only one of its kind in the whole country. But what is it? Think of the trust like a garden. In the garden, there are all sorts of valuable crops, cash, land, buildings, gold, coal, natural gas, and timber. All that land and cash is invested, generating the money for beneficiary-related programs across the state. In fact, the trust gets no money from the state's general fund. While the trust is a state corporation, it's more like a private foundation. The trust's cash investments are managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, and the land and non-cash assets are managed by a subset of the trust authority called the Trust Land Office. The trust helps pay for programs and services that help improve the lives of beneficiaries. These are Alaskans with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcohol and drug addiction, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. Every year, the trust awards more than $20 million in grants, but it does a lot of other important things, too. The trust is a leader in advocacy and policy, planning, and ensuring the state has a comprehensive, integrated mental health program. And the trust spends a lot of attention on key efforts that can really help beneficiaries, including substance abuse prevention and treatment, housing and long-term services and supports, employment, and disability justice. So that's the essence of the trust. If you'd like to know more, go to our website. You'll find us at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org.
Ah, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. Good movie. Like the movie. Just interesting. The first opening pictures had a quick shot of Putin, leader of Russia. What was that all about?
That popped up not as part of our queue and as part of our presentation.
Oh, okay. Okay, we just kind of like somehow got it. Okay, got it.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Through the chair, thank you for that little bit of history for us. As you know, dealing with mental health and addictions, and it seems to be one of our biggest puzzles here in this state. I appreciate that there's an independent entity that's raising funds to make sure that they get allocated toward fixing this, or at least making sure that Alaskans are offered services. I looked through your packet here, and I saw a lot on how the dollars are being raised and, to some degree, some of the grant pieces as well. What I'm not seeing, and maybe that's something that's not relevant for this discussion, Chair, but what I really would appreciate if maybe you could direct me to a source, and that is, I would love to know how you're seeing that $20 million in grants, for example, directly affecting the outcomes of alcohol and drug addictions, and, you know, where are we connecting more Alaskans to more services and seeing more results? I would love to know more about that. And the other piece I'd love to know more about is, it seems to me in the last few weeks, Chair, that we've been hearing a lot about positions that are not filled. And one of the greatest challenges, along with educators and public health, seems to be filling the positions of mental health care providers. I know firsthand so many families who cannot get help for their children or their elders suffering with mental health. And so I wondered if you have some specific programs happening that are successful, because we need to build on those on our end in other ways with regard to growing more of our own providers, and in addition to, of course, adding in telehealth and other things that we have done. I'd be very curious to know what you have to say on that end as well. Thank you.
through the chair to Representative Galvin. I think I might be able to touch on that a little bit later in the slide deck and hit on some of those questions that you've asked.
Thank you very much.
Representative Colom.
Through the chair, so I was trying to figure out a time to bring this up, so I guess maybe the history of the trust is the time to bring it up. One of my concerns, and I've talked to you about it in my when we've met too, is the recent Department of Justice report that we are not providing services to children, and we are over-institutionalizing our children, with a large percentage of those being Native children, which, again, I find a little ironic because that's the beginning of the Mental Health Trust. Was that, that's why it was created, is because we were not providing services for Alaskans. Specifically, we were sending them out, you know, to Lower 48, to institutions. And I know that it's an issue to try to find those community wraparound services, but we have the feds at our doorstep. They have threatened to sue if we don't fix it, so I'm just trying to figure out how the Mental Health Trust is going to pivot to try to make large improvements in a short amount of time so that doesn't happen.
Through the chair to Representative Colom. The DOJ report that was released in December of 2022, I have that, I've read that. The issues that are raised there and the concern, the very serious concerns that are raised there are to the point of the trust and its role in helping the state, you know, ensure that there's a system of care for Alaskans, in this case, children and adolescents, to be able to access early intervention, prevention, so that they don't need higher levels of care, and then also levels of care if someone needs a more acute, higher intensive needs care in Alaska. For the most part, trying to avoid sending individuals, children, out of state. Mm-hmm. So our partnership will be to work with the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services to look at, I know that both those departments are engaged with the Department of Justice right now, and working towards looking at the system and how we can change that for the better moving forward. There are some things currently that the trust is doing that should have an impact on some of the issues that were raised. Mm-hmm. You know, through our work in the Crisis Now initiative that several of the members of this committee are aware of, a bill went through the legislature last year, HB 172, that was sponsored by the governor and then passed by the legislature, would be to stand up mobile crisis response teams, which was something that was mentioned in the report, to stand up access to care at lower levels and shorter period durations of period of time, short-term crisis stabilization centers, crisis residential centers. We're actively working with Bartlett Hospital here in Juneau to try and stand up at the hospital chairs for adolescents. So those are just a couple of the ways that the trust is working to address and hopefully improve the system of care and some of the systems of care that were identified in that report.
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So that's some good news. There's some good things going. Has the board addressed the report? Like, just have they had a discussion about maybe redirecting grants in a different way to try to address that specific issue?
Through the chair to Representative Colom, no. The board has not had engaged in discussion directly related to the report that, you know, had the findings for the Department of Health and Family and Community Services.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, and Mr. Williams, I've been remiss in that I haven't read the report, but I'm going to speculate that it talks more about the state's obligations than the Mental Health Trust Authority. Am I right in that guess?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, absolutely, you're correct. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So I'm not going to spend a lot of this time, but it's already been raised that the history actually goes of the trust goes back to territorial days when the federal government was managing a health and social services system for the territory. At that time, if you did not have access to care or family or friends in communities that would take care of you, and your needs were too high and you came to the attention of the federal marshals. You were charged with the crime of being an insane person at large. And more often than not, folks were then sent to institutions out of state. As we transitioned into statehood, the federal government transferred 1 million acres of land through the Mental Health Trust Enabling Act to the new state for the sole purpose of helping the new state stand up a health and social services continuum of care. The legislature was designated the trustee of those lands, and the funds generated from those lands were to be the revenues for a system of care. In 1982, a gentleman by the name of Vern Weiss, who had a son with a severe and persistent mental illness, was unable to get care for his son. He looked into the history of the state and why his son wasn't able to access these services and recognized that the state had breached its fiduciary responsibility for these 1 million acres of land, filed litigation against the state in 1982. That litigation carried on forward until 1994 when there was the settlement of the lawsuit. And in the settlement of the lawsuit, there were a couple of key pieces. There was the reconstitution of the 1 million acres of land. About half of that land had been sold off and was not accessible, so they had to figure out how to identify new acreage to reconstitute that 1 million acres. That included the participation of folks from the environmental community, the conservation community, resource development, local governments, and others. They had to identify what the value of the lost lands were, and they did that and determined that $200 million the state had to pay into a trust that was deposited in with the permanent fund that serves as the corpus of the trust, and that's where it lives today. And then they established the oversight of the trust was established through a 7-member board of trustees, which we talked about earlier in the presentation. There are other elements of the settlement that I think are pretty critical. One is, and I'll touch on it later, is that our Board of Trustees by September 15th has to approve a budget for the use of trust funds. So only the Board of Trustees can approve the use of trust funds. And then by statute, the trust needs to include, the Board of Trustees needs to include recommendations for how, to the governor and the legislature, for how the state should be spending general fund dollars on a continuum of care for providing services to the beneficiaries that were identified in the earlier slide. So those are some of the key elements of the settlement. It's obviously there are more elements to it than that, but maybe that's for a different presentation. So with that, I'm going to get into the present and get into our financial positioning and recommendations for the legislature to consider. Before I do that, I just want to touch on and provide an update to the committee on the 2021 legislative audit of the trust. That was a follow-up to an audit that was completed back in 2018. Related to a number of different things. The 2021 audit had 5 recommendations. Some of them centered around our commercial real estate assets. And in November of this year, or November of 2022, the ledge auditor asked the trust to provide an update on those recommendations and the status of them. We provided that update to the ledge auditor, who then presented that to the Legislative Budget Audit Committee. And I'm happy to report that right now that no additional recommendations for action were necessary as reported by the ledge auditor. This is a history of the financial positioning of the trust going back to 1996. At some point, this slide is going to become a little bit too big for one picture, so we'll have to truncate it at some point. But I think one of the key takeaways of this graph are that you can see the overall growth of the trust over time. And you'll notice that there's a dip there in 2008, 2009, 2010. That was the national recession that happened. And I think a key takeaway here is that in spite of that recession, the trust was able to sustain itself, continue its grant making at the present levels, and then continue to grow moving forward. And a lot of that has to do with how we manage our assets and the draws that we take from our invested assets at the Permanent Fund and the Department of Revenue, the work of the Trust Land Office to consistently try and increase the revenue generated for the principal and the income of the trust. And then you can see towards the tail end that our real estate investment equity has grown over time as well. The top right call-out box shows you the amounts in the various colors of this column. I'll start with the green, which is the Mental Health Trust Fund at $531 million. The light blue is a combination of our restricted and unrestricted reserves, which is about $204 million. And then our real estate investment equity is sitting right now at about $73 million.
Representative Ortiz, and then Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, just so I fully understand this particular graph, the blue section, lighter blue section, does that represent the amount of money that you appropriate for programs for any given year? Is that what that represents?
Through the Chair to Representative Ortiz, no. That is our budget reserves. And we target 400%, having a reserve of 400% of the payout from the Perm Fund and Department of Revenue, so that going back to that 28, 29, 2010 time period, if in fact the investment and the economy takes a huge dip, we are able to maintain our current grant-making obligations.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So then what's the difference in terms of day-to-day appropriations or financial management of the trust? What's the difference between the green corpus and then the trust reserves? How are those managed differently?
Through the Chair to Representative Ortiz. So the corpus of the trust is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund. Our funds there are part of the overall APFC investment. We pay our portion of the management of our funds to the Permanent Fund. And then the reserves are a combination, that 400% that I mentioned. 200% of that is managed within the Department of Natural Resources or Department of Revenue, and the other 200% is managed outside of the corpus, but is managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation. And the that 400% target and the way the split between revenue and between the Perm Fund is something that we've looked at over time, and we've had Callan look at our assets and how we're managing and investing them. And that's the recommendation that has been brought forward and confirmed over time.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the Chair, Mr. Williams, I think you've almost reached the answer at the end of what you were just saying. You said that working with the Permanent Fund and with the DOR, it sounds like, and Callan, is that your consultant?
That was a consultant that was hired.
Mm-hmm. So they're giving you the suggestion for what the payout or what you should be spending on grants based on reserves and such that they suggest you to keep in your reserves. Is that correct?
Through the Chair to Representative Galvin. What Callan looked at was our 4.25% percent payout of the market value of the previous 4 years of the trust fund.
Okay.
And so they looked at that percentage, and they've determined that that percentage and the way that we calculate that allows for sustainability over time and equity over time, not only for the beneficiaries of today, but for future beneficiaries, because the trust is in existence in perpetuity. So we have to ensure that we're maintaining our assets in a way that provides equity over time.
Follow-up, Representative Galvin.
So through the chair, it certainly looks like you've been very successful in that effort, in particular. I would venture to say maybe even managed to get through some tough times better than other funds we've had in the state, remarkably so, and it's growing. And I guess my question would be, has there been any sense that the 4.25 maybe could be bumped to 5? In my estimation, that would be perhaps fuel for conversation, given that you've mentioned at the beginning of your presentation that your system is not meeting the needs. So I just wondered if there has been conversation around that so that we could be mindful of important investments ahead while still maintaining the long-term goal of making sure we have this available for our future generations.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, yes, this was revisited actually last spring in a presentation to the Trust's Finance Committee on how our assets are invested, the 4.25% percentage, and all of that was done by our consultant, Callan, who then looked at the whole picture, presented it to the Board of Trustees, and we are maintaining our current structure as is. And I guess the only other piece I would just note in the conversation is that the need is always going to be greater than the trust. The obligation to meet that need, going back to the settlement, when the settlement occurred, it didn't abdicate the state of its responsibilities to providing the funding and the services necessary to meet the needs of Alaskans who experienced any one of those health conditions that I mentioned on the third or fourth slide.
Representative Colomb.
Just quickly through the chair, the real estate equity, does that include commercial real estate? Because I'm sorry I'm new, but I was kind of confused by the legislative audit and the responses. It seemed like they suggested you should not be in commercial real estate, but they seem to be okay that you stay. So I was confused. Does that include the commercial real estate?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, that is the seven commercial real estate properties that the trust owns.
Okay.
So how does the board calculate the available funding for an upcoming fiscal year that it then allocates in a variety of ways? And so what you see on this slide is what the estimated FY24 available funding is. And the way this gets calculated, and I'm going to focus on the table on the left, there are four different sort of revenue streams that I'll describe. We've already touched upon the first revenue stream, which is our investment portfolio, but the important thing to note here is that 4.25% is taken off the average market value of the previous 4 years. So we're looking back, and by looking back 4 years, if there's peaks, if there's drops, this allows for a little bit of a smoothing to allow for more predictability and stability for knowing what trust funds are available to be accessed. The next row, prior years carry forward, again, look back 4 years. These are balances from grants that were either not expended or not fully expended, so kind of a lapse. We look back over the 4 years at that lapse, and we take the average, and you can see that for FY24, there's about $2.9 million average that's being calculated into what's available for FY24. The land office spendable income, this is the revenue that is spendable that's generated from the trust land office, which sits in the Department of Natural Resources and is managing our million acres of land and trying to maximize the revenue off of it. And so you can see that the land office is projecting, estimating that they will generate about $4.3 million. And then that last row, that $254,000, that's our low interest accounts, Jafonzi accounts or checking accounts, and there's about $254,000 that's estimated to be there, bringing us to a total of $37.9 million. The table on the right, to the right of that, shows you what the available funding was for the previous 5 years. And I think what you can see is generally there's some growth that happens at anywhere between $1 million and $2 million over the previous 5 years. I would note that the increase between FY23 and what we're projecting for FY24 is about $300,000, and that has a lot to do with what's going on in the volatility of the market nationally.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Williams, I am curious as to whether the Land Office has started to look at the idea of a carbon sequestration value. As you know, the Mental Health Trust Million Acres contains some of the largest stands of commercially viable timber remaining in the state, especially from Icy Cape to southern Prince of Wales. Mental Health Trust owns bigger swaths of land than the state of Alaska does, and when we start talking about carbon sequestration, the value of it, the examples that have been held out of both Sea Alaska Corporation and Huna Corp, and I'm wondering whether the Land Office has broached that as a topic, as a value to pursue, or whether you view it as you need to have enabling legislation that's now being pondered. But in many cases, when mental health trust lands come up, the discussion is always they don't have to follow all the state policies because it's mental health trust land, so access and notification can be done much more rapidly and responsive to markets. And it certainly seems to me like in the timber sequestration area, you got the trees that may be a value of a commercially viable product to sell. So have you started looking at it, or am I just planting the seed and saying, go do it now?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, I'll start by just saying when on any of the trust lands that we own, the Trust Land Office is looking at all the options for how to maximize revenue off of those. So that is the charge of the Trust Land Office. The other piece to the question is that the trust does follow the processes in place with the state to be able for how the revenue or the development off of those lands happens. So we follow those processes. I think that there are times where we have the ability to do it in a more expeditious way than others, but we do follow those. And then going back to your direct question around carbon sequestration, that's something that the Trust Land Office is looking at, can look at, but it's going to get weighed against all the other opportunities for maximizing the revenue off of trust lands. So continuing on, that $37 million, this is a pie chart that breaks down how that $37 million is approved by the trustees for expenditure. So on the top right quarter of the pie, you'll see our agency budgets. The Trust Authority Office sits in the Department of Revenue. The Trust Land Office sits in the Department of Natural Resources. You can see that the overall operations of both organizations is about 25% of the overall spend projected for FY24. The Trust Authority Office is largely focused on policy work, grants administration, advocacy, catalytic system change, like we're doing with the department in a Crisis Now initiative, and focusing in on what are the needs of the beneficiaries and how can we and the state and our other partners best meet those needs. The Trust Land Office, I've already touched on a little bit, their job is to manage our million acres of land, to ensure that it maintains value, and then to maximize the revenue off of those lands when opportunities present themselves. Going down to the bottom half of the yellow portion of the pie, MTAR. So this is Mental Health Trust Authority Authorized Receipts. This is a fund code that you will see in the budget. And when you see this fund code, you will note that these are trust funds approved by the Board of Trustees. So in FY24, they've approved roughly $9.8 million of trust funds to state departments, divisions, and agencies. The legislature is, when you go through the budget process, you are providing the receipt authority for the expenditure of the said department for the trust funds as determined by the trustees. On the left-hand side of the pie, the dark green, is authority grants. The trust has the authority to provide grants through the state budget process to our state partners, but it also has the ability to provide grants directly out to communities, tribal organizations, local governments, nonprofits, outside of the budget process. So we can grant directly to Juneau Alliance and Wellness here in Juneau, or Alaska Behavioral Health, or a tribal health organization like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation or Norton Sound Health Corporation. And so that slice of the pie is that $19.7 million are the funds that are going directly out to from the trust to communities, to organizations, to provide services and provide improved systems of care for beneficiaries. The italics there, that $1.9 million, of that 19.7, 1.9 is designated for providing direct grants that impact the lives of individual beneficiaries. So individual beneficiaries can apply for a mini grant up to $2,500 through an organization, and then that $2,500 can be used for a variety of things. It's extremely flexible. It can go from everything to helping to create a bathroom that is more ADA compliant, to clothes necessary for a job, to a housing deposit and last month's rent, just as a few examples.
All right, we have a couple questions. First, we have Representative Colom, followed by Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So on the trust authority and the land office, are those numbers, are those just salary, or is that lease, utility? Like, what does that include, the trust authority office cost?
Through the chair to Representative Colom. So the trust authority office has 17 FTEs. The trust land office has 19 FTEs. Those budget increments represent the salary for those employees. They represent the interagency charges to the Department of Revenue, to the Department of Natural Resources. They include trustee honorarium. It includes travel, so on, and other services and contracts.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. Can I do a follow-up, sir?
Follow-up, Representative Colom?
Because when I look at it, the agency budgets are close to what is MTAR, what you're spending on MTAR. So is there any kind of percentage? Like, is there a limit to how much you guys can use on admin, or is it pretty much just making sure that your administration is covered? Or is there a limit to you can only spend a percentage of the receipts?
Through the chair to Representative Colom, there is not a cap.
Yeah.
I will say that if you were to look back at our agency budgets over the last few years, you will see that they have been maintained relatively flat.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Mr. Williams, I'm looking at the yellow quadrant here. Looks like significant bit of dollars to go to state agencies. And I see later we refer to state agencies, but I'm really interested in growing the workforce and making sure we have more care providers. And I see that you put in a significant amount of money into that category. I'm curious to know a couple of things. One is, are those dollars filling the gaps where there were cuts from the state in other funds, or are they a plus? Are they adding on to what is already being done? And with that in mind, secondary question, if I could please, Chair Johnson, is are we seeing then an ROI? Are we seeing a sense that we are growing the amount of care providers in this state because of these dollars, or if we're just filling in holes where there were cuts, then maybe we're just maintaining the status quo?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, as a general proposition, in the history of the trust and the Board of Trustees that the trust does not backfill reductions made to other services that the state was funding previously. And then to your question around workforce, there are a number of things that currently, and maybe I'll touch on this a little bit later, that the trust is doing, trying to grow the workforce, not just for things like the SHARP program that provides loan repayment to out to our community partners, as well as the tribal health partners, as well as state government. The API, DOC, OCS use that loan repayment program now as a way to try to attract and retain a workforce serving our beneficiaries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And as we will try to get moving along here, so we can get the high points on the latter part of the presentation.
Going to the next slide, Representative Galvin referenced this. This is an illustration of where that $9.8 million of MTAR grants is going across the state system. There are 11 state agencies that we're providing grant funds to, 9 departments, the court system, and then AHFC. And I would note that the largest amount of trust funding goes to the departments combined, goes to the Departments of Health and Department of Family and Community Services. This slide is a table that I mentioned earlier in the presentation that the Board of Trustees, by statute, makes recommendations not only for how the trust spends its money, the approval of trust funds, but then recommendations for the state general fund mental health expenditures. The 3 columns in blue are what the trustees approved back in August of 2022 and then submitted to the legislature and the governor as our recommendations for state general fund spending. The columns to the right are what were included in the governor's FY24 proposed budget. So you will note that there are some places that the recommendations were not included in the budget. There were other places where the recommendations were included in the budget. I would say about 40% of the general fund mental health recommendations were included in the governor's budget, proposed budget. I would also just note that this isn't necessarily uncommon. In the history of the trust, when we've made recommendations for state general fund spending, governors have included all of it, some of it, or somewhere in between. So we're appreciative of what was included in the proposed budget, and we are working with the administration and the legislature as we move through the budget process to try and get these increments as recommended back into the budget. There are a couple of items on here that I want to particularly call out. Looking at the top, where we're looking at operating budget items, the second row, comprehensive program planning position. This is a jointly funded position between the trust and the department. This is the position that is serves as the point for the department's comprehensive integrated mental health program plan that they develop with the trust by statute. So it's been incredibly valuable over the last several years to have this position because that allows us a point person to communicate with, and we have someone in our office that is the point person in with the trust in the development and the monitoring of the plan. The other items that I would note are the Crisis Now Continuum of Care grants. There's $1 million increment recommendation as well as $500,000. This, and I'll get to it a little bit later in the presentation, the Department of Health and Family and Community Services and the Trust have been engaged in this transformational initiative since 2018. We're 5 years into it, and we've made significant headway in transforming the way we have traditionally responded to an individual in behavioral health crisis in our communities. And then the last thing I just wanted to call out is down at the bottom, the special needs housing grant program that wasn't included in the proposed. It's my understanding after talking with folks at AHFC and others that this was probably just an oversight. We're hoping that this will be included as part of the amended on when it gets released in a week or so.
All right, we have a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Williams, the Crisis Now Continuum, that I have a couple questions on that. part of my understanding of House Bill 172, along with helping people, was secondarily saving money. Am I right about those two features?
Through your chair to Representative Josephson, I think I would describe it as, and it could result in saving money, but making sure that the resources that we currently have are being allocated and used in the most appropriate and effective way. And I'm thinking specifically of law enforcement, where law enforcement is the direct or is the default response instead of what their traditional roles and responsibilities are. They're responding to people in crisis, which means that they're not going out investigating crimes, they're not doing their reports, or they don't have the time to do those things. Not that they aren't doing them, but their time isn't spent doing them. And so there's a piece to that. That could translate into savings, but it's really about making sure we're using the resources in the most effective and efficient way possible.
Thank you. And I was follow-up?
Follow-up,
I was thinking about the emergency room across as well. But am I right that at some point the Crisis Now model will take a large infusion of capital dollars? Don't we need structures to care for people in that sort of 23-hour to 7-day window that Crisis Now talks about?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes, there will definitely be a need for capital funding as well as that startup funding that allows for an organization who brings on a new service to have that transition period, because when they open the doors, they're not necessarily going to be able to capture all the revenue and the billing right up front. They're going to need that time to phase in the service, to be able to develop those processes to capture as much revenue as possible, and then be able to move forward and have a program or service that balances.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon and Representative Cologne.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Williams, since you drew our attention to that special needs housing grant, and then as I roll up to the two places where the Crisis Now Continuum of Care grants have been approved by the trustees but are not in the governor's budget, are we anticipating that they're going to be in the amended budget, or were those grants, you've approved them, but we don't have them in the current FY24 proposed? And I know that at least with the Crisis Now Center that's opening in my community here at Bartlett Hospital, FY24 is when they're expecting to be operational. They've just been under construction.
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, the trustees, these are recommendations. So for the governor to consider for inclusion. And we are hopeful that as we move through the budget process, that they might be included in the amended, a portion of them might be included in the amended. I will note that when we develop this budget, whether it's trust funds or state general fund dollar recommendations, we do that over the course of several months in the spring and the summer, and we do that in partnership with departments. So the trust recognizes that the departments can't commit, but what we are looking for is here's where we're headed. And would you agree that these would be recommendations that would be ideal if we were going to continue to move forward? Recognizing the trust in its budget process is slightly ahead of the other departments and the departments and when they develop their budget. So that's just part of sort of the way the systems work and how we've operated over the last 25 years.
One follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, do you know if the trustee-approved level of those grants for the Crisis Now Continuum of Care, would that fully fund the Crisis Now models that are coming online, or is that partial funding of those, and those programs would still need direct other service money from the Department of Health or local hospitals or wherever those Crisis Now models are being stood up?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that would not fund the total need.
Thank you.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, so I think when I looked at the supplemental budget, I think the special needs housing grant was in there. Don't hold me to that. But I did not see the Crisis Now grant. So I see that the recommendation is $1.5 million. So I'm curious if the governor doesn't put that back Is the Mental Health Trust prepared to pay that themselves?
Through the chair to Representative Colom, I was referencing looking forward to the amended budget, the FY24 amended, not the FY23 supplemental.
Okay.
And hoping to see that in the FY24 amended. And then we will continue to work moving forward through the legislative processes to, and hopefully get it into the budget in the end, at the end of the day, that gets signed by the administration.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Representative. Co-Chair Johnson, through the chair. Mr. Williams, I'm curious to know, you referred to the second line item here, the comprehensive program planning position, as being in statute. Would you clarify that a little bit more, what you meant by that, just so I understand the language?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I wasn't suggesting that the position was in statute.
Okay.
I was referencing the plan.
The plan is in statute, so there may be a need to have a person there to help coordinate that. Correct. Is that what I'm hearing? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This just gives you a sense of the grants and their impacts. I'm going to pull out a prop here. You all, a couple weeks ago, should have received a copy of the Trust Annual Report. But then you also received a separate publication, which is the Trust FY22 Investment Report. And this gives you the 170 grants that were awarded in FY22, the organizations that received them, both state organizations and organizations outside the state system. And it represents around 22 communities that received grants. Organizations that receive grants from the trust. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide. I know we're trying to make up some time, but just something for you to know. The column on the left just gives you the categories, how we categorize the types of grants that we award. So this next slide talks about how we develop our budget. I mentioned just a few minutes ago that when we develop our budget, set of budget recommendations, our staff would work with our community partners, our statutory advisory boards, and others to develop budget recommendations that fall into our four focus areas that are outlined up here on the slide, and then our other priority areas down below: workforce development, early childhood intervention, and prevention. I would note that the reason that the trustees over time have established these focus areas and these priority areas is so that we're channeling our resources, both financial and staff, in a focused way to address key issues that impact our beneficiaries, as opposed to what I often describe as a scattershot approach. Someone's applying for a grant for this, we're not paying attention to how it connects to something else, and you just sort of don't end up seeing the system as a whole, and you don't end up having an impact on the system that can change it for the benefit and for the long term. We also are engaged in policy and advocacy, and these are the areas that we spend a lot of time with our partners focusing in on community-based services, because we know if we can intervene early, if the services are in the communities available to individuals, that hopefully they don't go into crisis or have to access higher levels of care that are more costly, more traumatic, and sometimes can pull individuals out of their communities and away from their families. The workforce development, I mentioned the SHARP program, but I would also note that the Trust is heavily engaged, and this is a part of our Crisis Now work, in trying to use peers, people with lived experience in recovery, as a part of our workforce to get individuals who are in a challenging time to engage in treatment services and a path towards recovery, whatever that looks like for them. Medicaid is an important piece of our advocacy because, by and large, our beneficiaries, their health insurance is through Medicaid, and then the transforming of the behavioral health crisis response system, that's the Crisis Now one.
And I know you're going to talk about the behavioral health crisis response in this next slide, but I was wondering if you have any information on how many
response calls, the you know, that they went on. I'd just kind of like to hear more about that.
To the chair, that'll be a good segue. The answer is we have some data that we can provide to the committee related to the Fairbanks mobile crisis team that's been operating for a little over a year now. We can gather information from the Anchorage Fire Department, who has what we call a paramedicine response, an EMS with a social worker that's responding. So we can get you some of that information, the committee, some of that information.
Very good.
I'm not going to walk through this timeline with the committee, but I think it's important to note that this is an illustration of a commitment that's been going on since 2018 between the department and the trust to transform the system. Some of the things that I think is important to note is when you're talking about systems change and transforming a system, it doesn't happen overnight. And this work is being done not just with the trust and the Department of Health or Family and Community Services, public safety, corrections, tribal health working organizations, community partners, trust beneficiaries themselves. For the system to change, everyone has to understand where it's going and be a part of that change to the extent that they can. And so what we're trying to do here is create a system where there's parity to how someone accesses an emergency response for a physical health condition. You call 911, you know what you can expect in terms of service. You call 988, you call the care line, you should know what the expected response would be in terms of a behavioral health crisis. And then my last slide for the committee is a highlight of the work of the Trust Land Office. I mentioned Justy Warner is the executive director of the Trust Land Office. She has a staff of 18. I've mentioned the mission of the Trust Land Office. And what you see here on the table to the right is sort of the assets of the Trust Lands and where we are projecting anticipated revenues for FY 23 to be generated from. So whether it's coal, whether it's oil and gas down on the Kenai, whether they're minerals from Fort Knox and Kinross, whether it's materials, sand, gravel, rock that gets used for transportation projects around the state, whether it's timber that gets harvested on lands in Southeast, Prince of Wales Islands, whether it's the lands. We do a fall annual land sale. Actually, this past fall, the land office generated $2.7 million just from that one fall land sale, which exceeded what it was in 2022. And then our commercial real estate. We're also looking at how we might be able to capture revenue through fees related to public utility easements that either exist today or new ones that would be running through trust land parcels. I think with that, Madam Chair, I didn't highlight, I mentioned the land sales. The revenues from the U.S. Forest Land Exchange has generated roughly $7 million for the trust since the land exchange. We are projecting $20 to $30 million over the life of that land exchange. The Icy Cape development is trust land down north of Yakutat, where we're looking at the possibility of minerals coming off those lands to generate revenue, and then the easement program I did mention. With that, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
All right. We have a question. Co-Chair Edgman.
Well, first off, I want to thank you for an excellent presentation. Every year, I think the Trust Authority comes before the legislature and proves that it's doing a lot of things to help programs in need serve in real time, but at the same time, sort of at the leading edge in terms of innovation and taking the lead along with other partners on a program like the crisis residential centers. And speaking of House Bill 172, which we passed last year, that when I first learned of that bill in this committee, I was very intrigued by it because the potential to me is maybe more than the mind's eye could see at this point if it all comes to fruition, particularly if those mobile crisis centers can be built out in the bush and other places. But given we have a couple minutes, maybe, Steve, to give you a chance through the co-chairs an opportunity to you know, maybe talk a little bit about that? I would imagine that the trust authority doesn't do like a five-year planning session sort of trying to project forward, because this is a program back to House Bill 172 again that, you know, a report was generated, and there's some other elements to that bill that sort of will go along at their own pace. But I just wanted to give you a sense to maybe build that out a little bit and where that whole program could go. Because I think if it comes together, its impact is going to be far-reaching.
Through the chair to Representative Edgeman. So this initiative to transform the system to do better actually was sparked out of a lawsuit against the state by the Disability Law Center and the Public Defender Agency, because individuals in behavioral health crisis were sitting in hospital emergency rooms or the Department of Corrections, having not committed a crime, waiting for access to care. When that happened and the settlement occurred, the opportunity to say, let's use this crisis as an opportunity to transform the way we respond to Alaskans in these crisis healthcare conditions, we can do better. And so we started the work by doing an assessment, national review of where other states are doing this and how are they doing it. And we landed on what's going on in Phoenix, Arizona, with the Crisis Now model. And that's the model that was identified. We then had folks from the trust contracted with RI International to come up and do an assessment of Alaska's system of care in this area, and focused on three communities to start out with: Anchorage, Juneau, or Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Matsu Valley, and looked at what the current capacities were, where were their gaps, what was the possibility, and what do you need so that you don't overbuild, but to meet the needs of the individuals in those three communities. And so a work plan was developed to look forward on how you develop a call center, how you develop the mobile crisis response teams, the short-term crisis stabilization, the short-term residential, which is up to 7 days, and then you have your higher levels of care. You're at the beds that are operated, DES, DET beds that are operated at hospitals like Bartlett, API. So there's a continuum. That work has resulted in mobile crisis teams operating in Fairbanks, mobile crisis teams in Anchorage. The Matsu Valley is just now rolling out. Because of this work, there are other communities that are interested that we're partnering with to help them sort of get a foundational understanding to know what they can be doing in their communities. Copper Center, Ketchikan, Kotzebue, just to name a couple, Juneau. As we're moving forward, the systems in these communities are looking at how do we do better, and how do we not just take what Arizona is doing and plop it into Ketchikan or Juneau, because we know that the community of Phoenix and those two communities are strikingly different. And so you have to take the principles and the foundations of the model, the capacities and the needs of the community, and then adapt those so that the communities understand what it is they need and how they can deliver those services to in a better way. This is going to be, you know, several years continuing. This doesn't happen overnight. But we are seeing results. So.
Just a quick
follow up, Representative Kosher.
I mean, transformation, right? If it all comes together?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Stapp, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair to Mr. Williams. So, kind of to co-chair Edmund's point, first, I kind of want to applaud the Mental Health Trust with your really your fiduciary responsibility. I mean, this is a pretty solid investment portfolio. Seems well managed. It has very good risk tolerance. In fact, assets under management look to have more than doubled since 2009. So one of the things that always concerns me, and kind of piggybacking on what Coach Edgeman mentioned earlier, is though assets under management have doubled, outcomes are going backwards. So I have a sheet in front of me. It's from the Healthy Alaskan Scorecard. It's a nonprofit. Suicide mortality rate in youth has increased substantially since 2009. Suicides of age 25 or older has increased substantially since 2009. Adolescents who feel hopeless has increased by almost double since 2009. And alcohol-induced mortality rates have increased substantially since 2009 as well. So my real question to you is kind of what can we as a body or me as an individual do to kind of help you further your mission to kind of build upon the things that have happened previously? Thanks.
Through the chair to Representative Stapp. Those are tragic and alarming statistics that you just recited. Those are our families, our friends, our Alaskans, trust beneficiaries. When you talk about any one of those categories individually, or you kind of start grouping them as a whole and you're seeing that there's significant trauma, I think you have to look at the system. You have to look at the system as a whole and understand what it is that is, what are the myriad of variables that are a part of one individual's decision, using the example of attempting suicide. And it's not just the health and social services sector. It goes across other places. It goes through economies, you know, workforce, jobs, sense of community, loss of sense of community, things like that. Though all of those things are pieces that can be a part of that individual's reaching a place that is so overwhelming that they're actually considering taking their life. Mm-hmm. And so part of your question was, what can we do? And I appreciate the plural there, because this is everyone. The trust has a role in this. Our communities have a role in this. The legislature has a role in this. Alaskans in general have a role in this. If we really want to turn the curve and really address some of these very tragic situations, we need to understand when people are at these places and reaching out and trying to offer our support or helping them get to a place where they can find support. We need to make sure that the home and community-based services that are in our communities are funded in a way that allows them to be able to provide the service at the cost that the current cost of providing that service, the ability to recruit and retain professional staff to interface with individuals in the community, to make sure the services are culturally appropriate. When needed. These are just some examples of the complexity of the things that, the tragic things that you identified. And, the ability to, change, those statistics is going to require a sustained, concerted, and comprehensive approach. No one thing is going to solve or transform or turn that percentage to something in that is positive or events that don't happen.
All right. Representative Josephson, and then followed by Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, to follow up on Representative Stapp's question, you were very eloquent in your response and explanation. It seems to me there's almost a near perfect analogy to the discussion of funding K through 12 education, in that there are people who believe we need to approve up the value of the funding. How do you with data, et cetera, and accomplishments, concrete accomplishments? How do you respond to that? And do you make adjustments where you say, we're going to try this tack and that didn't work, and so we're going to pivot to something else? So it's sort of a combination question. Both how do you respond to someone who says, not that Representative Staff was, I'm not suggesting he was, but says that we're not making sufficient progress, and you've sort of given us your answer to that, but also this need to pivot.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, when the trust awards grants, whether it's through the state system or to a community organization or a tribal health organization, there's a grant agreement that outlines what the intent of the funds are to be used for, as well as what are the expected outcomes for that particular grant. And so if the grant, and going back to the trust as an innovative catalytic funder, we expect that there will be some things that just don't play out the way we would have hoped. But that's okay, because we can learn from it and we can pivot from it and do something different and say, well, that didn't work and here are the reasons why. We can kind of adjust, or we can say, well, it just didn't work out. And so we look at that as an opportunity for, you know, looking at our grant outcomes, looking at the performance, to help guide us in directions that prove to have positive impacts for our beneficiaries at a systems level. Therapeutic courts would be an example of that. The trust would, in partnership with the Department of the court system, corrections, and others, really invested heavily early on in the 2000s related to therapeutic courts. And we did that because we wanted to demonstrate the value of those or not. There was one project that actually didn't demonstrate the value of it, and the trust didn't continue funding it, nor did we come to the legislature to say this is something that should be funded. So that's sort of the – I don't know if that hit exactly on what you were saying, Rep. Josephson, but
– Follow-up, Representative Josephson.
Actually, more of a new question, to be honest. May I?
Okay.
All right, through the chair, Mr. Williams, related to House Bill 172 – you saw that Senator Klayman has filed a bill on involuntary commitment. You may have seen that. My office has been working intensely on that issue as well. Has the trust had any meetings internally about problems where we're sort of beyond the 172 sphere in that that a mentally ill person poses a real and palpable threat to others? And we don't know that they're not chargeable ultimately because they can't be tried. They're incompetent to stand trial. And we don't know what to do with them. Has there been any discussion of that?
There's been no discussion related to, what was it, SB 53, Senator Klayman's bill that got introduced last week. I've looked at the bill. I've done just a very cursory review of it. But beyond that, no. As it relates to Title 12 in general, which is the statutes around legal competency, back in 2015, the trust, in partnership with the Department of Health and Social Services, the Public Defender Agency, the Department of Law, a litany of other state departments and non-state entities, looked at the Title 12 statutes to identify how they could be rewritten and updated because they were significantly outdated. And when you do that, you look at this interplay between Title 12, the criminal statutes, and Title 47, the civil commitment statutes. And that is what I think, if I remember, and I've only read that bill twice, but very cursory, that's the interplay that I think Senator Klayman and maybe yourself are looking at, is what happens when someone's charges are dismissed, but they pose they've been identified or evaluated to pose a serious threat to themselves or others. That's where Title 47 and the civil commitment statutes kick in.
All right, thank you. And then Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Mr. Williams, to the point that Co-Chair Edgman made around a game changer, I wonder if you could, if it's allowed, expand just a little bit. I see that you have real systemic ideas here on page 15. I know that you shared an example of Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, and I wondered if you could add a little more context and color for us who are looking for tangible changes in direction and possible outcome differences than what we were seeing through Representative Stapp's data from 2009 to now. If you could share with us a little bit of what you've seen as you studied Phoenix's example, knowing that Alaska will look different with, I understand you already are working with with Anchorage and Matsu and Fairbanks and Kotzebue and Ketchikan, and that's fantastic. But if you could help paint a little picture for us to know what that game changer might look like, that would be wonderful.
And sorry, just one moment. I just wanted to remind folks that I'm certain that Mr. Williams would be available to elaborate on anything that was here at if you wanted to schedule an appointment at a future date. But if you wanted to just quickly maybe touch on as best as you can as answer that question.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, I think that the short, concise, given the time answer is it's ensuring that someone has immediate access to the care needed. I mean, you look at the headset on this slide. That's someone to call when you're in a crisis, who answers the phone, who understands, is trained to address your situation and either help you work through it and resolve it and refer you to something, or if it is a crisis, get you to that place that can address the acute need.
Through the chair, if I could just have one very short follow-up. What I'm wondering is if you have any concrete examples of outcome differences through when Arizona adopted something like this and how they saw a reduction immediately in X, Y, or Z. That's all I was looking for. No long explanation. Sorry.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, we will try to get that information and provide it to the committee with the couple of other things that I pledged to get to the committee.
Thank you. All right. So thank you, Mr. Williams. Our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 7th. At 1:30 p.m., we will be receiving a presentation from the Department of Revenue. They will be providing an overview of the state debt summary and credit review. Presenting will be Ryan Williams, State Debt Manager for DOR, and Fadil Lamani, Deputy Commissioner for DOR. And seeing no further business before the committee at 3 o'clock, we'll call it 3 o'clock. We are adjourned.